18, which would have made me 21 years old on the 13th of October in 1940. When the draft was originally proposed, the sign-up was for a young man who would be 21 by about the 10th of October or September, something like that, in 1940, which would have excluded me. However, along about July or August of 1940, this was changed to include anyone that was born that would be 21 years old by the 20th of October or some such date, which would have included me in the draft. Therefore, I decided to enlist in the Air Force rather than getting drafted in the Army. Along about September 20th, I went up to Aurora and talked to the folks there. They said that they had a place for me. I guess they always do. And then about the 25th of September 1940, I went to Chicago and took the oath in the evening. And we were put on a Illinois Central train and sent to Chinook Field in Grand Coulee, Illinois. Yeah, we got there sometime after midnight or the morning of the 26th, I believe, of September. And they issued us a pillow without any pillow cover and two blankets. And indicated we should spend the rest of the night in a six-man tent, which there were several on Chinook Field at that time. It was cold. Oh, it was awful cold. We had this pillow with no pillowcase and one blanket under us and one blanket over us and left most of our clothes on. And we got up in the morning and it was really cold. They didn't have any basic training for us there at all. They just kind of moved us around to the different medical briefings and things like that, and took our shots. Nothing actually much happened for about two or three weeks. We just stayed in the tents. A few odd things happened, like a couple of tents that catch fire from the stoves in the center. Our tent didn't have a stove, so we didn't have to worry about that. There was always a little excitement when the tent caught on fire. They were pretty close together. And some of them I seriously think were arson, or just something to do. And along about October, I had applied for the trainer school. And it didn't start until January sometime. Maybe it was December. I don't know. Anyway, in the meantime, they put me on to work with the fire marshal on the Chinook Field. I just can't remember his name. But there were a couple other of us fellows in the same group. One of them was named Eads, and the other was Connor. And we'd go to the fire department every morning after we got done eating breakfast. Sit around there and all polish their trucks or go around and check the fire hydrants to see if the water hadn't leaked up near the top so they'd freeze. It was getting along toward winter, and it was pretty nasty. Wasn't a bad job, though. I really enjoyed it. And the fire chief, I can't think of his name. He was a real nice old civilian. And he took good care of the firehouse. Of course, we didn't go on fire calls. We were just kind of slaves around the house. And then about December, let's see. I came home on the day before Armistice Day in 1940, and I hitchhiked back. It was only about 140 miles, I guess, 120 maybe. And on the way back, I was riding with a fellow, and a storm came up, and the wind blew, and we were heading south on Route 47, and his hood came unhooked at the front end with an old Mercury, and it just came up and just covered up the windshield completely. He ran off on the right hand side of the road and got it stopped. Didn't hit anything. We got out and wired it down and went on. We got back to Chinook. And he just moved us into barracks. and it really snowed. This was 11th of November, 1940. And really was a bad day. Cold and snow, and the wind blew out of the northwest, blew about half the tents away, and there were fellows from the tents moving in and doubling up in the barracks. And we considered ourselves lucky to already have been assigned to the barracks. Of course, we didn't know that in less than a month there'd be measles and scarlet fever and just about everything breaking out. And when that happened in the barracks, they were all, each barracks was quarantined. And that lasted all the way from 48 hours to 5 or 6 days. And I finally started Link Trainer School, and we went from 6 o'clock in the morning till noon each day. And we have to get up 4 or 5, clean up and make our beds, get to breakfast and go to school. It was a good school. They had about 6 or 8 Link Trainers and good instructors, and really enjoyed it. But this was broken about, training sessions were broken about 3 times by measles or scarlet fever or something. And they dropped us back a part of a class once, and then we went at night for a while to catch up. And finally, the 1st of April, around the 1st of April, 1941, we graduated. And then we had about a week before they knew where we were going. And this was anxiously awaited, of course, by all the graduates. And while we were waiting, they had to think of something else for us to do, and that was when I caught my KP. I had about 3 or 4 days in a row, or else I'd get theater guard. That was the best. You'd go stand by the door and see that they didn't block the aisles, and you got to watch the movie. But KP was rough. We'd go real early in the morning. We stayed out all the way from 5 till 8 o'clock at night. I remember one day I cut over 4,000 pieces of cake in these large army baked tins. It must have been about 30 inches old, 24 inches wide, and about 32 or 38 inches long. You had to cut them 4 one way and 7 the other. And I figured out it was over 4,000 pieces of cake I cut. Now, of course, that wasn't a hard job, but it was kind of monotonous. And then about 10th April, I got my orders. 24th Air Base, Anchorage, Alaska. And the other two fellows that I chummed around with, one of them got sent to Alaska with me, and the other one got sent to Philippine Islands, Clark Field. I never heard how he made out after the Japanese invasion and captured all those people who weren't killed, so I never did find out how or if he survived. I was home about the 10th of April for about a week, and I just fiddled around. They were starting to farm. And then on the 18th, of course, I got married. That was a big day. And on about the 21st or so, I got on a bus in Earlville, went to Chicago, and took another bus to New York City. And went on the turnpike, the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which is new. And we got to New York. I was stationed at the Brooklyn Army Base for a couple of weeks, I guess. And we just had cleanup details and KP and odd jobs like that. And at night, we practically always go downtown, get on the subway, and go down to Manhattan Island, go to a show. One day, I rode the subway all day long for a nickel. Most of the days, you put a nickel in the turnstile and get in. And as long as you stayed and changed trains or anything like that, then you could ride. So I took this nickel, and I had 20 cents on it left on my paycheck. I took a nickel and stuck it in the turnstile, got on the subway, and I had a sandwich and an apple, and I stayed on all day long. I think it was about 9 o'clock at night I got off, and I'd gone clear up, way up past Harlem, and out to Queens, and out to LaGuardia Field, and down to Coney Island, and just riding all day long. it was really interesting. I saw a lot of interesting sights. Go across the Brooklyn Bridge 3 or 4 times, and up across the George Washington Bridge once. It was, I suppose I probably went 200 miles from Nicollet. And of course, we visited the Statue of Liberty, went up in the Empire State Building, did a little shopping, and took the Staten Island Ferry. That was another nickel ride. Seemed to be well worth it. Took about 20 minutes each way, I guess, and it was a pretty good sized boat. And finally, they ordered us up from Brooklyn up to Fort Slocum. That's an island, small island off New Rochelle, New York. And this is New Rochelle, New York. And it was rough. They had us doing stuff all the time. They'd make us get a haircut if we hadn't had one for 2 or 3 days. There was a bunch of old lieutenant colonels over there in charge of the island, I guess. And they'd just stand around and look for you to do something wrong, and then they would immediately relay it down to you through the sergeants in no uncertain terms. We pick up paper on the parade ground, and we'd rake leaves, and just all the time. We were busy all the time on Fort Slocum, and everybody just hated it. And it was pretty hot. This is in June, I think. And then, I think the colonel saw we were all draftees, and they had a strong dislike for us because the draftees were coming in then. And just like draftees have always done, I suppose, they didn't really seem to fit into the colonel's idea of an ideal military life. And then about the latter part of June, we got on a special train. Must have been 100 of us. Engine and 3 cars and a baggage car. And we got on the train at New Rochelle. And we took off for San Francisco. You see it. Brooklyn Army Base, they were going to take us around through the Panama Canal to Alaska. But when we got up to Fort, they decided they weren't going to do that anymore. So they took us to Fort Slocum, and from there we got on this train. And it went day and night steady. Oh, I don't know, it was about 3 days, I guess. 2.5 days, a real fast train. Going through Texas, it was some of the track was washed out, and they had to go real slow. It was pretty monotonous, nothing to do on the train, of course, just eat, sleep, read, tell stories. We got to San Francisco in the middle of June. The sergeant in charge gave us a big briefing talk when we got off the train. And we went to Angel Island. We got off the train and, well, I guess it was Oakland. Then we got on a, no, it was actually in San Francisco. Then we went down to the foot of the Van Ness Street, and we got on a ferry. And it took us right past Alcatraz Island, and we went past this a little further out into the bay, and here's Angel Island. It's about 3 miles, I suppose, in diameter. Got a mountain in the center, about 1,000 feet or so. There's an army barracks there, and that was almost as bad as Fort Slocum. We did KP there. We started at 4 o'clock in the morning. And after KP, I didn't find something else for you to do, too. And it was, they had real tough sergeants. It was a real poor place to be. Nobody enjoyed themselves. The only thing that was good was they had free movies, and Sunday you'd get off and they had a ball team. Some of the other fellows and I walked around the island on Sunday. It was about, 3 or 4 miles, I guess, around the island. And then we climbed up to the peak, looked around, watched the China Clipper, the flying boat take off for China. This was in the latter part of June, 1941. And we could see both bridges from Angel Island and the skyline from San Francisco. And of course, they let us go about once a week or sometimes twice a week. They'd let us take the ferry over to the mainland of San Francisco, and that was always interesting going to see some of the sites in San Francisco. And then about the 20th of June or 25th, something like that, we got on the U.S. Grant, a troop ship. It was long and narrow, and we started for Seattle. And that took about a day and a half, I guess. and really rolled up. We got up, went underneath the Brooklyn, or the Golden Gate Bridge, and turned right and started up the coast, and we stopped in Astoria, Oregon. We got off, I don't know what they stopped for, but we went in there, and they let us off the boat for a while, and we walked around town, but there wasn't much to see in 41, so we came back down the boat, and that night we sailed again. Or no, I guess it was the next morning. When we got out to the we had a pilot aboard, looked like he was 70 years old. We got out to the ocean from Astoria, it's kind of a little, well, it's the end of the Columbia River there, I guess. And the waves were really high. We're still on the U.S. Grant. And out where we hit the ocean, there was a fellow in a rowboat, and the waves were at least 30 feet high. And this 70-year-old pilot, they stopped the ship. The boy in the rowboat came rowing up alongside, and actually the water went up and down the side of the General Grant at least 30 feet, at least. And this old 70-year-old man, he went down the ladder on the side of the ship a little ways. This rowboat would go up and down, up and down. And finally he stood there and held on with one hand and one foot. And when the rowboat was just in the right place and came up the side of the ship, he just dropped into it. And that would make anybody great. Now let's see, the next morning we went in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, or whatever they call it. Went past Port Angeles and Whidbey Island, headed for Seattle. And at Seattle, we were unloaded and sent up to Fort Lawton. That was an old army post up in the north edge of Seattle, right on Puget Sound. And we stayed there for quite a while. We go down to Seattle. I think it was about 4 or 5 miles. I know I walked down one Sunday down to the USO or YMCA or something, some kind of a thing they had for servicemen, played pool, things like that. Seattle was pretty dirty, I suppose it just wasn't a very clean-looking town. Port Lawton wasn't too bad. They didn't work us too hard, and we had a few odd jobs, but nothing really hard work. Moved a piano for a colonel once, and helped mow the lawn, picked things up, move things around. Spent the 4th of July, 1941, in Fort Lawton, Washington. And had the day off, of course. We just walked around, looked at the sights, and took pictures. Then about the 6th or 7th of July, we went down to Seattle and got on a little boat called the Clevedon. C-L-E-V-E-D-O-N. I think it was an Italian ship that was captured during World War I. Motor ship, 260 feet or something like that. There were about 14 of us Air Force men on it. And that was all, in addition to the crew. And we took off for Seward, Alaska. Cleveland rode pretty rough, although the water wasn't too bad that time. And we got to Seward one morning real early. Went in real early in the morning. We saw the rocks out at the opening to the bay, and it was foggy and looked terrible. This was in the latter part of July, or middle of July, 1941. We landed at Seward, and they just had one wharf there. And a great big building alongside of it, and they just pulled up and tied it up, and we all jumped off and went inside the building, stood around. Pretty soon they said, well, we're going up to Anchorage by train. And there's mountains all around Seward. Just west of Seward, there's a mountain that goes up about 45 degrees, all covered with trees. And I suppose it goes up 2,000 feet anyway. Anyway, it looked dangerous. Like the snow might fall. I suppose the snow would have slid off if it hadn't been for the trees. Seward was a real small town. I don't suppose it was, maybe 2,000. All wooden buildings. They had several severe fires, disastrous fires. We got this little train. It was a steam engine. pulled by a steam engine. It had about two cars, and we started up the mountain. We went past a glacier on the way to Anchorage, and it was ice and snow all around, right in July on the mountains. The train went about 15 miles an hour, made a couple complete circles, crossed over itself, and then we got to the edge of the Cook Inlet. We went across a bridge and got over on the Anchorage side of the Cook Inlet. Went right along the side of a mountain. Even the waterfalls coming down, sometimes it would splash in the window on the train. You know, it would splatter in. And we came to the end. We could see the end of the mountains up ahead. We came to the end of the mountains. They were on our right. And there was a field. And there was a fellow with a Fortune tractor out there plowing. And I just about fell out of the train. I thought everything would be pretty primitive, but they had a pretty good sized field. He was plowing. I don't know what he's going to plant it at that time of year. Anyway, he was plowing it. We went on into Anchorage. I suppose it was probably town 3,000 or 4,000. Got off the train. They put us on army trucks and out to Elmendorf Field. Elmendorf Field was the main base there. And right alongside of Elmendorf was Fort Richardson, the Army base. And we got assigned to the 24th Air Base Unit. Met the fellas and got introduced all around. Assigned to a barracks, went and ate supper. The next morning, went to the our usual briefing. And they said they had too many link trainer instructors for the machine. They only had one machine, one link trainer. And there were about five of us available to operate it. And it would, three would have been the most they could possibly use. And by very judicious management, we were able to all be retained as link trainer instructors, and we worked short hours. And link trainer was at the top of a top story of a two-story combined hangar and maintenance shop. And they were just building the rest of the main part of Elmendorf Field then. And while we were giving training, I experienced my first earthquake. We were on the top floor. I was operating the machine, the link trainer, and sitting at the table, and I felt the desk tractor shake, and I started to get up, and I kind of wobbled around. I sat down real quick, and the dust rose up from the floor, and the windows rattled, and the link trainer was tipping one way or the other, and the lieutenant that was inside, he raised the hood up real quick and said, "Who's got a hold of this?" And it only lasted about 20 seconds, I guess, and it was done. But you even see the dust outside that raised up from the ground. We heard later that two men in a cabinet on the side of a mountain had fallen down into a ravine, and they were killed, but that was the only serious damage. The 18th Pursuit Squadron was stationed at Elmendorf when I was there, and they were our near neighbors on the runway, on the taxiway, and they had P-36 fighters. I think they had a couple of 30 caliber guns, and then one over the hood, one over the cowl that fired through the propeller. They weren't very formidable looking, but they were very maneuverable. Another thing about them, when it got a little later in the fall, they were awfully hard to start. They had a shotgun starter, and they put a shell inside the plane someplace in a little case and close it up, and they'd fire it, and the engine turned about one revolution. And then generally it would stop. And I had seen as many as 50 of those shotgun casings out on the taxiway there where somebody tried to start a plane. And they had ropes that they put on the props, and two or three guys take all of them and pull them through. And that also was a little futile. But once they got them in the air, nine of them could do a loop, and they'd all be in the loop at once. And they do Immelmanns and Cuban 8s, and a very maneuverable airplane. We were real pretty. I didn't know any of the pilots personally, except this one, Hazel Kine, who I ran into about 5 years later in Clark Field, the Philippine Islands. When I was there, I was kind of interested in navigation, and there was a navigating officer there, Lieutenant B-E-R-O, Barrow. He kind of took an interest in me, I guess. So he'd give me some forms and things to work navigation problems, and I built myself a sextant that I could, well, I could figure out a position within maybe 15 miles, 10 or 15 miles, which I thought was pretty good. He seemed to think that was rather surprising because I made it out of wood and with a protractor and magnifying glass and a level out of a carpenter's level. But it had some batteries and I had a little bulb in it. It was pretty accurate, but kind of a plaything. And along about December 7th, I guess it was, we went to Sunday dinner, and the fellows across me said something about, they had a big Japanese were attacking Pearl Harbor. And one of the fellows across the table probably said, yeah, he said he started that rumor. And about 10 minutes later, it became pretty general. Something was going on, and before we finished our meal, the colonel came in and explained to us that from what he had heard, the Japanese were bombing Pearl Harbor. This was around noon on Sunday, December 7th. And that night, it was black and angry. We actually thought we were next. And we had to have blankets over all the windows and no lights after dark and a lot of extra guards. And within a week, why, three of the Link Trainer operators were, instructors were put on guard duty. And in the depth of December in Alaska, when all people were trying to be on guard duty, three or four nights I went out in the woods about a mile or two from the base and walked around about 500 oil drums, or 50-gallon drums were full of gasoline for the 45. And I would be accosted about three times during the night by the sergeant of the guard. And it was pretty cold. Well, it wasn't awfully cold, but if you had to stay out in it, snow on the ground, a lot of snow. And I think the coldest it got when I was there was 9 below. The days were awfully short. Along in December, we'd go to work, first part of December, we'd go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning at the Link Trainer office. And get up and eat breakfast, and it was pitch dark. Go to work, 8 o'clock, it's still dark, you couldn't see a thing. About 9 o'clock, you'd start getting a little light, and the sun would start showing. About 9:30, the sun would come up over the Chukot Mountains that were east of Elmendorf Field. And then noon wouldn't be too bad. The sun would be shining. It'd warm up a little. A lot of ice skating up there. 3 o'clock or quarter after 3, the sun would go down. You'd go home from work at 4:30, pitch dark. It did make a long night. And there wasn't any place to go over to Anchorage. Didn't have many, well, they did have a Red Cross station, or whatever you call it there, just before I left, but I just went to it once. And along about January, they had a big call for pilots. Oh, I immediately rushed over to the medical officer, and he said, no, my visual accommodation is insufficient. And I had a little trouble in the eye, so I immediately started eating carrots and taking vitamin A pills and all kinds of subterfuges to become accepted. And then along the 1st of February, they came out with a paper again. Anybody wanted to go up their duels? So I went and took the test, and I passed. I got my orders. Around the 1st of March, I went down to Seward on the train, got on the St. Mihiel. That was a huge boat. we took off from Seward and went out into the Bay of Alaska, and it started, blew up a terrible storm. And it snowed, and it was just awful. And we were out about one day, I guess, till we got to, it seemed like it was Keeps Venture. I don't know for sure. Anyway, it was the north end of the Inland Passage. And from then on down the west coast of Canada, we went on the Inland Passage. It was beautiful. It was cloudy and windy, but the water was smooth. Beautiful scenery. We stopped at Ketchikan. I don't know why. We stopped there for a while. And one of the boys I used to know was running an Air Force crash boat there. He came up alongside and brought some mail. I talked to him a little. He was surprised to see me, of course. There were about 30 of us going back to cadet school. And we got back. We landed in Seattle again. Must have been the middle of March, 1941. And we were there maybe 2 or 3 days. And it changed entirely. There were a lot more men there, and it was a lot stricter, and it was just much worse than it was the summer before. And around the 15th of March or so, we got on a train. And we went by train to Santa Ana, California, about south of Los Angeles. And we were put into a big holding base there, I guess, staging base. And there were a lot of men there, some of them going to cadets and some weren't. And that was the first time I ever saw Bob Hope. It was around the latter part of March or the first of April in 1941. He came and did gave one of his early USO shows, I guess. It was pretty good. He told a few shady jokes, and they had several luscious-looking females on the program. It was well-received. And about the 1st of April, they shipped us out to Ontario, California. This is just east of Pomona, east of Los Angeles, about 20 miles. And we were south of Ontario. This base is Cal Aero Academy. It looked like a country club. Nice one-story dormitories and two men to a room, and they had covered walkways all around, and everything was really A1, PT-17 steerings. And we started training about 1st of April, 5th of April, something like that. And I had about 3 different instructors before I sold them. The first one, his name was Mr. Brown. He was an old farmer that lived near Ontario, and he farmed, and he also taught aviation cadets. This is a sideline. First day he took me up, we flew around a while, and he said, there's a hawk down there a little bit on, chasing a little. And I never got sick in a plane in my life, and I didn't then, but that was about the closest. He said, check your safety belt, hang on, it might turn pretty quick. So I took a hold of his eyes, and he dove at this hawk, and the hawk was soaring about 400 feet off the ground. And he'd go around the hawk and turn, and it seemed like about 300 feet, and he'd come back again, and the hawk was, rather seriously annoyed. And one time I thought we got him with the inner wing flying wires, but it just evidently was on the outside strut. Mr. Brown, he was laughing. That was a big time. I imagine he was 45 years old, 50. He wore glasses, medium size. He weighed about 180. And then he quit. I don't think that had anything to do with it. I only had about 3 hours training from him, and then another instructor came. It was quite a turnover instructor, Cal Aero. And another instructor taught me for about 6 hours, and something happened. He got transferred to basic. And the last instructor I had before I soloed, he was a real nice guy. And I think I had about 11 hours when I soloed. 10:30 or something like that. It didn't bother me. I always landed in the grass. If I was going a little bit sideways, the way to just slip. And primary was a lot of fun. We did quite a bit of solo work after we had solo runs. And there were, every once in a while, you'd see a unauthorized formation go by. And you're first starting to fly when somebody pulls in and flies formation with you. It's a little frightening. It seems impossible that they won't hit you somewhere. And at the end of primary, we had a test by an Army instructor. And he took me up, or rather, I guess I took him up. We flew around a while. He seemed to be satisfied with most of the things I did. So on, he kind of shook his head. And we did lazy eights and chandelles and the snap roll and didn't do a loop with him. And several other things. Finally went back to the base. He said, come on the pattern. So I started, entered the pattern satisfactorily, I guess. He didn't say anything. And I got on the downwind leg and turned on the base and everything was all right. And I started to turn on the final. He said, where are you going to land? And I said, right down there alongside the runway. He said, no, land on the blacktop. And that was the first time I landed on the blacktop. And I came down with my normal 15-degree crab, I guess. And we hit the blacktop, and it wasn't anything like landing on the grass. And it kind of skittered along sideways there, and I was sitting in the back fighting it. And he didn't touch the controls. I give him credit for that. He had a lot of nerve. We taxied over to the ready room. He got out and said, you almost grounded. And I told him, yes, I never landed on the blacktop before. He said, no, practice that. And he got out his paper and he started writing down what was the thing. And he said, well, he said, it wasn't a very good ride. He said, but Uncle Sam really needs pilots, so I'll pass you on basic. Naturally, I was elated. Basic, we went into BT-13s, low wing, fixed landing gear. Voltees. Nice airplane. That was the first airplane I flew at night. So that's a pretty cool. Especially when there's a lot of traffic.
The only thing really good about it was Los Angeles. We were close enough to Los Angeles we could see it real well from the air at night. Of course, they didn't black out the West Coast. It was all lit up. It was a really nice sight. But we only had about a 6 mile square practice area, or four of them rather, on four corners of the field, and it always seemed as though someone was closer to you than they should be. And it took a little figuring to say, well, now this is a green light or this is a red light, which way is it going? You always worried about your instruments and how high you were. You had to maintain a certain altitude, and once in a while they let down somebody from the 6,000 foot altitude when you were flying in the 5,000 foot altitude. And it was always exciting to watch him go by. But we didn't have too much time. It lasted about a couple of weeks, I guess. We had 60 hours of flying time in basic. They kept real close track of that. We had 60 hours in primary, 60 hours in basic before we moved on to advanced. In basic training, I saw my first crash. There was another fellow went to the same class I was in. We were flying in an auxiliary field, landing in an auxiliary field one day. It was pretty busy. I think they had about 12 VTs there, and they had an instructor on the ground with a control plane with a radio going. And I just taxied up and got out of my VT and was walking over to check in, telling where I was. I looked over, and there were two VTs on the final approach. And the one in the rear, the furthest from the field, all of a sudden looked like he stalled, and he made a sharp turn to the left, and he started right straight down and just disappeared behind a hill. It was about a mile from the field. You couldn't see what happened to him. And I rushed over to the control plane, and I said, one of the planes looked like it went down. And so the instructor of the control plane called the other planes in the pattern, asked if they'd seen anything. No, they didn't see anything. He started counting the planes, and he said, oh, I think they're all here. And I said, well, I don't. I ran over to the edge of this hill. It was a little way back from the end of the runway. Looked over the top, and there was a lake down there about a half mile away. It was about Fuller's Lake in England. And right in the middle of it, there was a landing gear of a VT sticking out of the water and part of the tail upside down in the water. And so then I rushed back and told him there was a plane in the lake. Just about that time, he heard that there was one in. And we got in the bus that took us over there. And the bus moved down pretty close to the edge of the lake, and we jumped out. And by that time, there was somebody, of course we couldn't tell who it was out of the airplane and was sitting on the inverted plane, right on the fuselage. He was about half out of the water, and he was hanging on the landing gear, which was pointing straight up. And I took off my flight coveralls, and I was going to wade out. I didn't think it was very deep. And just about that time, a rowboat came rolling down the lake real fast. And they pulled over to the plane, and this fellow was able to climb in. And the rowboat brought him to shore. His face was all cut up real bad. We could tell who he was. It was Monty Powell. That was one of our buddies. And he was gagging, spitting up mud and water. We laid him there on the grass and called for the bus to come on down. And I took my coveralls off and we put those on him to kind of keep him from getting too cold. And then we put him in the bus. And he could talk. He said he just felt like he was all full of mud and he was bleeding pretty bad, and we kind of bandaged him up. And took him in the bus, and we went up this hill where the ambulance was on its way then. We took him up to the top of the hill and took him out of the bus and laid him on the ground there. And I thought he was just about gone, but he was still conscious. The ambulance came, and they just loaded him right up and put him in the ambulance and took him to the hospital. And the plane was just completely wrecked. The wings were torn clear off the fuselage. And actually, the wing was in a different place. It landed almost... He hit the water almost straight down. He stalled out on his final approach. And 3 days later, he was out of the hospital. His face, his forehead was all scarred up real bad. One of his eyes was pretty badly bruised, but he didn't lose any of his facilities. And later on, I heard he went into glider training. We got an awful lecture from the medical officer of the base for moving him. For carrying him in the bus, but the ambulance, I don't know why, I suppose the ambulance could have gotten down there, but they didn't seem to think that they would. And this bus was a pretty sturdy machine, and of course we carried him in the bus. He was sitting in the seat, and I sat alongside him in my underwear, and I think that's all I had left. And we got him off the top of the hill. Oh, he was all right, but I suppose it would have been better to leave him there. We hadn't had any first aid training, and we thought the quicker we could get him to an ambulance, the better. But he turned out all right. They did drop him out of the class, of course. If you wreck the plane, you're automatically out. And it was a real, real spectacular crash. He said he hit the water. I talked to him later. He hit the water. He was doing about 200 miles an hour, he thought. He stalled in the final approach, and he got into the wing wash of the plane ahead of him, the prop wash. And he stalled it out, and he went to put the throttle on. He claimed that it didn't take, and it dropped off in the left wing, and just made a left steep spiral right into the water. And the instrument panel was all caved in. His head had hit right at the compass, and it all caved in. And it was just miraculous that he didn't get a severe skull fracture. I don't think he even had what they called a concussion. He was just a really lucky boy.